My name is Paul Olson, and I'll be part of this, but you will be an even bigger part. It's about black poetry, and it's about radical truths, as that title says. And I'd like to kind of act as your recording secretary and record on the board what you say are possible definitions of those two words, the key words in the title of the session, poetry and radical. What do you think radical means?
To the root.
Somebody looked that up in the dictionary, I think. Sounds pretty good.
Radicals know what that means.
You have to relay that word. It means wonderful things.
To the roots. Here, you guys who just came in, you can have these poems. We'll eventually get to it. Okay, what else? To the roots. Good, enough. Let's go to poetry. This will be harder, probably. I think poetry is. I'm not looking for an academic definition. I think, in fact, the best place to start with literature is from your guts.
Picture.
Yeah, great word for it. And I'm going to add one. I'm adding images because poetry is pictures, and that's the most important part of it. But it's not only pictures. It's sounds. It's the recall of smells and all kinds of senses that are pushed into that one word, images. That's very good. Other things.
Struggle.
Poetry is struggle. I remember a struggle for me. Yeah, ninth grade poetry, I gotta read this stuff. Struggle.
Usually has a special message.
Yeah, there is. We'll put that in there.
Symmetry.
Who said that? God, I hate those big words. You gotta spell them and all stuff. Is that right? Symmetry?
Yeah. Yes.
The longer the longer you teach freshman English, the worse you spell. Let me tell you, everything looks right after a while. Okay, what?
Discipline.
Parables.
Condensation.
I'm going to change that to condensed, just so it isn't water drops. It's good, though. It is, for sure it is, intensified.
To be totally honest, incomprehensible. I mean, I just can't understand so much of it.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to spell that.
No, I don't mind spelling that.
Call it vague.
Anger and love.
Okay.
Left brain.
No, right brain. Right brain.
I'm dyslexic.
I wrote them both down. Since we don't know any of us, left, right brain, put a question mark there.
A moment in time.
Nice phrase.
Involved.
Pardon me? History?
History.
Yeah. Wow. We're really taking off. This is great. Okay, class dismissed. That's all I wanted to know. You got that down? Do those two words and your definitions of those two words, and we could go further, but we won't. Do any of the words down here fit up here? Any of the words up here fit down here?
Yeah, true.
That's kind of interesting, isn't it? I think it is. That perhaps we're saying that poetry is radical. How can that be? We'll look at some specifics, and that's what this session is about, to do that. But before we do look at the specifics, how can poetry be radical? Just by its nature, I'm suggesting, or I'm asking.
It comes from the soul, isn't it?
So, okay, I'll buy that. So the soul, because when we come, when we bring something from the soul, it's always radical.
Oh, a truth is one thing I want to
say. Well, and there you go too. The mean that when we tell the truth, it's radical. And other times, I mean, we're saying pretty interesting stuff, I think.
Poetry invites experimentation.
Yeah.
I don't see controversy up there.
I'm putting it up right now. Experimentation. And you can put these words in both places too, can't you? Controversy, experimentation. This is a great group. I can tell that already. Okay, let's move on. Let's flip this over. I think I got a clear board. Yeah. I have four kind of purposes today to pull us together in this. One is to do just what we did, and you did a tremendous job. What's radical, what's poetry, and get kind of an atmosphere, an attitude set up as we look into these things. The second thing to do is very quickly, we're going to write a poem. Anybody want to walk out now? No, we're going to write a poem collectively, though. And I think the way to do that, I mean, that's, I don't know if it's ever been done before. You know, a collective poem. Keats did not get together with Wordsworth when they, you know, when they composed the Ode to the Grecian Urn. And the way to do that, I have in mind, is that we have to write about some experience, and the only experience that we've all shared in common is Holden Village. And we want to kind of narrow that down, because there's a lot of different dimensions of Holden Village, of course. So you pick one. One dimension of Holden that we can write, say, a 4 or 5 line poem about.
As I was walking down the street.
Luda. Okay, we're going to write about the food. Now, I'll flip back to those definitions of poetry that you had. And let's just put down some... And let's start with, I think, since the most important beginning for poetry... well, that's a hard thing to say, I guess, but I'll say it, partly true anyway. The most important thing to begin with is the pictures, the images. What are the images of food at Holden that we can put together?
Smell of fresh bread.
Okay.
Healthy.
Healthful.
What?
Healthful.
Okay, now that's a great word, but I don't know what that means. My 15-year-old teenager thinks potato chips and Hershey bars are healthful. And you think, you know, whole wheat bread, and it's a different story. So, if we're going to have good poetry, generally speaking, we're going to avoid generalizations, and we're going to avoid kind of value judgments, although the poem in itself will be a value judgment, but not yet. In other words, the smell of fresh bread, we can all experience, we can all have that happen to us. What we think is healthful is going to be really varied.
Good
so,
old, good
what?
Old fresh butter.
Fresh butter. Speaking of, your brother has been here many, many years. Fresh butter, Holden. You can turn the tape on now. Okay. But we don't have fresh butter. You say we do, you say we don't. What do we have?
Margarine.
Butter-like substance.
Butter likes.
Holden butter.
Holden butter.
Holden butter. Fold butter.
Fold?
F-A-U-X.
Oh, fold butter. Oh, okay. You gotta be an English teacher. Okay, for sure it's yellow. I mean, we can all buy that. Keep going. We'll go a little faster.
New combinations of grains.
Whole grains.
Whole grains.
Bread.
Honey.
Honey.
Yeah. Peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Waiting for the bell.
Ringing the bell.
Okay, now we're moving on to not just food, but the meal time itself, which is an experience. Okay, and waiting for the bell. Let's just take, and then we'll stop. Waiting for the bell. Just look at the images we can put under that one. Waiting for the bell. How do you wait? How does that 3-year-old wait? Where do the 10-year-olds wait? Where do they all wait?
At the bell.
At the bell. All of them grab their hands on a rope, right? Okay, we got an image of that. So we got How do we say that? Nothing fancy, just in a specific image, the 10-year-olds.
Running up and down the
hill. Gridlock at the bell.
Okay.
Buying to be first at the bell.
Yeah.
My turn.
That's a stretch.
Running up and down the steps, someone said. Are there any kids? I mean, aren't there a few hands on the rope all the time? Several? Yeah. On the bell rope. You had ever had a course in hieroglyphics? You are now. After a while, it begins to look. Okay. Several hands on the bell. What else?
This is a restraining adult there.
What?
A restraining adult.
Yeah, good. I thought you said a straining adult. All I could think of was hemorrhoids. I don't okay, a restraining adult. We're about that age, I guess. Yeah.
There's always a rush in the dining hall setting up stuff. The waitress setting things.
Yeah, okay, good. What's an image of that? This rush of all these.
Do dishes clang or clatter or clatter from the kitchen?
What?
Clatter.
Clatter, good. And that's the rush. The rush and the clatter. Let's just stop, because we could go on for a long time, but we want to get to what this is really about. We just kind of wrote a poem. Well, what does that whole little thing do?
It shares an experience.
Yeah, it shares an experience. And if we were going to tell somebody, how do you describe mealtime at Holden? You know, how do you share that experience? I mean, we've all tried it. We go back home and say something. What, do you go to a cult or what? I'm sure everybody's had some kind of response that's been, how do you explain this place? And unless you really get pretty specific and start to pull together all kinds of images that tell the truth about that experience, we really don't get very far. Are there any more sheets there to grab? On the floor there? Yeah, good, good, okay. So now, how you want to put those images together and polish this poem and order it and put it in the kind of syntax that you want and so on, that you can do that at home, and that'll be your assignment. It's due tomorrow. Okay, we started on that. How do you suppose, from the canon of American literature that has been, you know, too long traditional, but is now slowly changing into bringing in things other than the white poets, how do you suppose, and we'll guess before we look at it, black poetry or African-American poetry might be different from white poetry?
A different experience of life.
You know, in American history, as we look at that, we have created by our unfolding history and culture, we have created a phrase called the black experience. And it seems to be that the black experience, I mean, the black poets talk about it, the black novelists, autobiographers talk about the black experience. And it's different because, as we said in yesterday's session, those people's grandparents were slaves, and our people's grandparents, I'm saying ours, the white people in the room, were, name it, but they weren't slaves. And that's a very important difference, of course. And that's the beginning of what we've, you know, now labeled as the black experience, slavery is. Okay, how else might you say there'd be a difference? What would you expect?
Language.
Why would you say that? Not to pin you down, but what makes you, how would language be different? Other than?
Well, from the experiences they have, I think the language evolves.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Yeah. For sure that the language of experience A is going to be used differently than the language for experience B. And we call them peanuts, and the slave narratives call them goobers. And that's a language difference. Yeah, okay, that's a good answer. Yeah.
It's an uneducated language.
Sometimes, that's true.
Yeah.
And the older the poetry is.
They use English language, but it is of their own origin.
Right. And we want to be careful. It's an accurate observation that an uneducated language doesn't mean an unintelligent language. Sure. The intelligent language of even the 18th century poets, and there aren't very many of those in America, black poets in America, the language is uneducated, but it is surely not unintelligent. It's perceptions into the workings and the forces of historical definition in society. There's great insight. So that's an appropriate answer. Anything else?
The earlier black
Yeah, and some of it does. And some of it doesn't, because in the 18th century, for whatever this is worth to you, this, although this is on the quiz at the end of the hour, in the 18th century, how do you get published? Well, you don't get published bringing out the truths about the oppression that's brought out in slavery. So you're a Phyllis Wheatley, and you write an occasional poem, or an incidental poem, or a celebrative poem. George Washington crossed the bridge, and I remember that day, and here's a poem to celebrate his greatness. And it doesn't really have what one would call black identity. Well, it's because, wait a minute, what you're going to talk about is slavery, and who's in charge of what gets published, and that's not only 17th century stuff, I mean 18th century, that's 18th, that's 19th, and to a large extent, it's 20th century even. But good. What else might you expect?
Seeing the same thing differently.
Yes. Great answer. Seeing the same thing from a different perspective. And those of you who were here yesterday talking about slavery, the phrase that came from one black critic was, it is not he who looked on, the white woman and man, but he who endured. Who can tell you what slavery is? And those who endured have a very different perspective from those who looked on, to use those two phrases. That's a good answer. Anything else? Would it be radical? What was radical about this? And we said poetry, in a sense, is radical.
Well, pushing an idea that doesn't fit my way of life.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
It wouldn't be as radical as it should be because it wouldn't get published.
Yeah, that's for sure an historical truth, a literary historical truth about poetry. It doesn't get published, so it can't get published, so it doesn't really push the truth too much. And then late in the 19th century, some poetry does, but it does it through spirituals, folk songs, folklore, and that becomes poetry when it's written on the page, but it still is rather disguised. Then we get into the 20th century, disguised meaning this is the black experience. We get into the 20th century, and then there's kind of almost a revolution of movement from poets and novelists and all kinds of black writers that moves from describing it as it is to protest. And in fact, there's a phrase, the protest novel, and there's protest poetry. And then finally get up into the 60s and the 70s, and we have something about radical and rebellion. This is the rebellious period, and that's some of the poems that we have here to look at today, too.
Getting into the teenage category.
Getting into the teenage category, if that means it challenges conventional ways of perceiving the world. That's kind of what our poem did here. It's pretty easy to go home and say, the food is weird, says my kid. Or, the food is really low on the food chain. Or, you can think of these generalizations that do not tell the truth about a Holden meal. And you have to tell the truth about it. You have to get very specific. And in a sense, I'm suggesting to you that in our understanding of radical, that begins to move us into now we're going to see the truth about this. You mean I'm going to eat bread with little nuts and grains and stuff in it and pieces of corn and yeah.
Lasagna.
And lasagna. Right. And on and on it goes. And then we take this step towards... And that's what's radical, I guess, towards truth. This is the meal. Move it into our analogy, out of this analogy now. This is our experience. Okay. I'll illustrate for you a difference in my own introduction to black poetry, which occurred in 1965. And I was a high school teacher then, and I taught juniors in high school, had a lot of guys in class, and I was real conscious of this idea that poetry is about love and flowers. And I want to bring poetry that goes beyond that idea so I can fire up some boys for poetry too. And a colleague of mine gave me a poem and it goes like this. I've memorized it perhaps partly out of guilt, but also partly because it's in a one-man drama show that I do. The title of it is To James. And it goes like this. Do you remember how you won that last race? How you flung your body at the start? How your spikes ripped the cinders in the stretch? How you catapulted through the tape? Do you remember? Don't you think I lurched with you out of those starting holes? Don't you think my sinews tightened at those first few strides? and as you flew into the stretch, was not all my thrill of 1,000 races in your blood? And at your final drive through the finish line, did not my shout tell of the triumphant ecstasy of victory? Live as I've taught you to run, boy. It's a short dash. Dig your starting holes firm and deep. Lurch out of them into the straightaway with all the power that is in you. Run straight, run high, run hard, save nothing. And finish with an ecstatic burst that carries you hurtling through the tape to victory. Is that what you'd call a black poem? Is there anything particularly aimed at the black experience? White boys and girls, the poem's written in the time when Run Your Race Boy, that is what would be written. Run track two. Well, the collie that gave me that poem on a Xeroxed sheet, or in those days, a mimeograph sheet, set at the top to James, and then the poem at the bottom, anonymous. This was 1965. I was in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. And then I went to graduate school, and I learned that anonymous had a name. And his name was Frank Horn. And he had all kinds of poems about all kinds of experiences that all kinds of different Americans share. Some of those experiences particularly aimed at the black experience, some of those aimed at an even broader kind of collection of all kinds of human beings. But in 1965, Frank Horn was anonymous. And I don't know, I never could find out, how many times that poem and how many high schools that had gone through that had been passed out Frank Horn's poem under the name of Anonymous. And I tell you that story to suggest that part of the difference between what has been a part of our traditional canon and was a part of my traditional canon as a young English teacher in 1965 has been hidden away from us. I mean, the black canon has been hidden away and has had a real struggle to get into the accepted canon, the accepted curricula of English and American literature in high schools. And in colleges, for that matter, too. Well, so what? The so what is, this is a good poem. It was especially good for those young boys and my purpose of trying to get them out of flowers and love, right? It's about track because it's running and it's races and they liked it. But it's under this name or this anonymous. And no wonder the black poet struggles in the 18th and in the 19th and still in the 20th century for some kind of sense of identity. And that idea runs through all the poetry that we see that has been written by blacks. Who am I? How can I boldly state who I am when I do? Anonymous. Well, we'll move out of that. And look at some of the poems that are here on the sheet I gave you. You have a front and a back to that. And I am 15 and I'm going through puberty. I think the place to start is perhaps Kitchenette Building, the bottom right. This is written by Gwendolyn Brooks, the poet laureate of Illinois. Surely, in any measure, one of the great poets of America today. I'll read it through. And then you can just talk about whatever you want to. What I want you to notice are the images. We are things of dry hours in the involuntary plan. No image yet, and I won't stop anymore. Grayed in and gray. Dream makes a giddy sound, not strong like rent, feeding a wife, satisfying a man. But could a dream send up through onion fumes its white and violet, fight with fried potatoes and yesterday's garbage ripening in the hall, flutter or sing an aria down these rooms, even if we were willing to let it in, had time to warm it, keep it very clean, anticipate a message, let it begin? We wonder, but not well, not for a minute. Since number 5 is out of the bathroom now, we think of lukewarm water, hope to get in it. What do you make of that? What, you're always late for the last one into the shower? Or the onion fumes and the fried potatoes?
sounds like a person really living in the now and having a dream that things have got to get better and can get better. Pray God will get better.
Okay, they've got a dream, but... Yeah, good.
It sounds like everybody's first apartment.
Everybody's first apartment.
I didn't fry onions in mine.
Sort of relaxed babbling.
Yeah, relaxed babbling and babbling about...
Whatever.
Yeah, this is today. Living in the now. Onion fumes, fried potato. Go ahead, I heard.
Oh, frustration. I have this dream, but I can't. There's too much to do, and
yeah,
no way to.
And what does she have to do?
Desperation.
She has to take a bath.
Just take a bath. That you're kind of looking forward to that. What else does she have to do?
Push down the dream in order to get through the reality. She can't let the dream take over.
Okay. Good. And with real specific stuff, what is it she has to? What's pushing it down? What's pushing down the dream? I'm asking a literal question here. Yeah. Frying onions. What?
The necessities of life.
Yeah, all these necessities, like onions and fried potatoes and yesterday's garbage. And that's there. And what looms biggest in her life? Those things, right? Getting the potatoes. Paying the rent. And in their family, feeding a wife. And in their family, satisfying a man. And the day-to-day things that... And so, what kind of a, then you have all these specific images, and you step back from that for a moment, and what do you say? What do you say about her dream? Their dream?
No time, no heart to keep it alive.
No time. And the presence, the power of day-to-day physical existence doesn't give a chance for spiritual existence to grow.
Not for a minute.
And that's what a finish. Not for a minute. We wonder, but not well, not for a minute. Since number five is out of the bathroom now, and it's my turn. And the water's warm. And reality and dreams.
Also, in the first line, the involuntary plan, like she's caught up in something that's not of her choice, where she never makes choices.
Right.
And then the dry hours, the thought of dry and dusty, things can't grow where it's dry and
great.
Dusty.
Very good.
Well, and second line, too, is a dream that's just a giddy sound, something, flight of fancy that's
very good.
Contradictory to the reality.
Nice phrase, flight of fancy. And these things of dry hours and involuntary plan, it's the black experience in contemporary urban America for her. Then it transcends an immediate specific experience and says some even universal truths about, as all great poetry does. It moves from the specific experience, and we can look at several of them, but that very specific experience into something that is a universal truth about the nature of life. And the best poetry speaks not only about the social natures of life, but about the spiritual dimensions as well. And the spiritual dimensions of this person's life, as you said, make sense. These abstract words like dry hours, I mean, as a freshman English teacher, I'd say, you can't say that. You know, a dry hour. I don't know what it means. You can't say the involuntary plan. I don't know what it means. Until you have all those images. So what are some images, and then we'll be done with this, of the involuntary plan? You said it, that's such an important thing. Her plan, it's not, I don't choose to do this. I don't voluntarily.
Trapped.
What?
Trapped.
For sure. Trapped. What's the universal truth about that to all women and men? Trapped.
Feeding a wife, satisfying a man.
There you have it. Feeding a wife, satisfying a man. How do we do that? I remember Ron's Bible study from 2 years ago, that's what's caught us up more than anything. Satisfying a man, feeding a man, feeding a wife. Each of us as readers experiences every day.
It's slavery.
It's slavery that dooms the dream. It's slavery that dooms the sense of spiritual arrival and spiritual awareness. And it dooms the chance to get away from it all.
But I don't relate to the involuntary plan treatment. I go through this rant, feeding the wife, satisfying the man with great gusto. I enjoy it. Part of life.
Yeah, the work you have.
Yeah.
That you do. Sure. So is it all bad then?
Well, in this poem, it sounds like it's a certain amount of just resignation. I don't hear any anger. I don't really hear sadness. I hear a certain amount of just resignation. She's living in this kind of a flop house where you're sharing a bedroom.
Yeah.
People's garbage are out in the.
Yeah.
You know, someone's garbage is in the hall and someone's cooking it again at the same time.
Yep.
And it's just sort of resignation. I don't hear any gusto.
That's a good observation. And that tone fits your phrase of this is slavery. And what can I do?
It's sort of a Good Friday poem. This man, this woman, is a butterfly, not able to get out of this damn cocoon. To me, it's sort of a Good Friday poem.
Yeah.
And the hope of Easter.
What an image, what a metaphor. It's a butterfly in the cocoon, you can't get out.
I was looking at the last line, and I think we assumed it's a shower. I would believe it would be a bath that looked warm because it's another dirty people in it.
Yep. And it's been used by, number five is out, and now it's not good.
I was just going to say, obviously we all have different, reading it through different eyes. And that's interesting to hear the different perceptions of it. To me this sounds terrible, like, oh, I guess it has to do with me not wanting to feel trapped like that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You're having dreams still, but possible.
Yep, that's good.
I also see her as doing she has a lack of choices because she says she wants to flutter or sing an aria down the hall, and she's not given these choices, and that's maybe what to me I see some pain in because of that.
Yeah. Very good. And she doesn't have it. It's good.
Maybe the lukewarm is that middle place where you're not dreaming and hoping and thinking of something else and not deep down in the pit in despair, but just hoping for lukewarm water where you can just kind of be. Because she also says about the dream, if you're willing to let it in.
Yeah, that's good. Just for a moment, think of the most profound spiritual question that you could ask. And you ask it, but I don't have time to do that right now because I got to go shoot pool with my son. I don't have time to do that right now because I got to fry the onions. I don't have time. The most profound question that you would ask in your life intimately, and how much time it takes to deal with that, whether it's a dream or it moves into that kind of realm, which makes this, in my opinion, makes this a pretty grand poem because it elevates frying onions and paying the rent and dirty garbage into the concept of how do we get a hold of our spiritual selves. That's why Gwendolyn Brooks is the poet laureate of Illinois, perhaps. Well, let's move on. Anybody else want to say anything? You sure can. But at the same time, there's a lot of good ones here. Just to the one above. Well, no, let's have fun. They're all fun, but let's have fun on the back side, a poem to complement other poems. This is a 1960s poem. This is one of those written by what are the so-called revolutionary black poets, and Don L. Lee, that's what Lee means up there, is the poet in this. This is radical poetry, and I have a page that I'm going to do on, I guess it's Friday, that's even more radical, because the language is pretty rough, but we'll watch this one through. I have heard Don L. Lee read this, and he reads it something like this. I'll give you another little bit of literary kind of background. It's called a stage poem, and it's meant to not really be performed, but to be read out loud, and it's not a page poem, it's a stage poem, and to be read through in the kind of attitude that suggests hurry up and a kind of intensity. Change, like if you were a match. I'll put my glasses on, that's the first change I've ever made. Change, like if you were a match, I would light you into something beautiful. Change, change for the better into a real, real together thing. Change from a make-believe nothing on cornmeal and water. Change, change from the last drop to the first. Maxwell House did. Change. Change was a programmer for IBM, thought him was a brown computer. Change. Color to something written on southern outhouses. Change. Greyhound did. I mean, they got restrooms on buses. Change, 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 nigger. Saw a nigger hippie, him wanted to be different. Changed. Saw a nigger liberal, him wanted to be different. Changed. Saw a nigger conservative, him wanted to be different. Changed. Niggers, don't you know that niggers are different? Changed, a double change. Nigger wanted a double zero in front of his name, a license to kill. Niggers are licensed to be killed. Change. A Negro, something pigs eat. Change, I say, change into a real black righteous aim. Like I don't play saxophone, but that doesn't mean I don't dig train. That's Coltrane to say. Change, here you're coming, but your steps are too loud. Change, even a lamppost changes, nigger. Change, stop being an instant yes machine. Change, niggers don't change, they just grow. That's a change, bigger and better niggers. Change into a necessary black self. Change like a gas meter gets higher. Change like a blues song talking about a righteous tomorrow. Change like a tax bill getting higher. Change like a good sister getting better. Change like knowing wood will burn. Change. No, the real enemy. Change. Change, nigger. Standing on the corner thought him was cool. Him still standing there. It's wintertime. Him cool. Change. No, the real enemy. Change. Him wanted to be a TV star. Him is. 10 o'clock news. Wanted, wanted. Nigger stole some lemon and lime popsicles. Thought them were diamonds. Change, nigger, change. No, the real enemy. Change. Is you or is you ain't? Change. Now, now, change. For the better, change. Read a change, live a change. Read a black poem, change. Be the real people, change. Black poems will change. And then he reads this ending like this. No, the real enemy, change. No, the real enemy, change. Change your enemy, change. No, the real, change. No, the real enemy, change. Change. No, the real enemy, the real enemy, the real, real enemy. Change your the enemies, change your, change your enemy, change your enemy. Know the real enemy, the world's enemy. Know them, know them, know them. The real enemy, change your enemy, change your change, change, change your enemy, change, change, change your change, change your mind, nigger. Yeah, wow. One of the things that's going on here, that we can talk about if you want to, but it probably goes without saying, is that the black poet is deliberately going against the traditional accepted conventions of poetry because he couldn't get published that way anyway. Remember To James? That's pretty conventional. Do you remember how you won the last race and on about, you know, a race? Nice little poem. It's great. It's a good poem. Anonymous. So then that black poet, some of those guys say, your whole idea, this is a rap, your whole idea of what good poetry is white, Anglo-Saxon, viewed with blinders, and this is what a poetry is, and if you don't model after, pull out one out of the hat. After a Keats, it can't make it. Change your mind. What we've, what the white society, and that's one of the statements in this poem, what the white system historically, presently, culturally has imposed upon, you know, what are blacks for? Is this the poem that says we're licensed to kill or be killed?
Yeah.
No, let's put them on the front lines in the World War II. Let's send them, you know, we know all that stuff, okay?
The thing that I see here is that, yes, he's speaking of the white society, but he is really bashing his compatriots on the head with a club.
Yeah, and that begins to move this poem out of just, hey, whites, look what you've done, into, look at all of our change, our mind, that's the last phrase. You know, we go after. We're so, I mean, look at that one image. We're so compelled to make money. We're so materialists. That this grabbed those lemon popsicles. I thought they were diamonds. And I thought that's what really had value. Change your mind. Want to be a TV star. I mean, fame. Think of all the things that just materially pull us through the world. That's a radical voice. I love to use the phrase myself when I look at black poetry about the radical voice in the wilderness. And the wilderness is the American society that's pulling at us from all kinds of ways. And then there's this one voice. It's the poet. Change your mind. So, and what a great tie-up. And so it's not only if the structure of the society isn't going to change, and we've seen this kind of values been going on for hundreds of years, right? Thousands. And I mean, any story we can find anywhere suggests the struggle between mammon and God. Very good. Change, 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 the jingling pocket in the tip. Yeah.
But, you know, change.
And change too. Change. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Enslaving, still enslaving.
Yeah, very good. I like that. I like even what you made me think of, the chains in the pocket and that kind of materialism, and change is better.
Out of this whole thing, the one that jumped out at me was this phrase, something pigsy. Boy, that hasn't changed. I mean, this is a 60s phrase, with pigs meaning the policeman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh.
That just jumped right out at me.
Yeah. Good.
Eat.
Yeah.
And the pigs, if we use that phrase in the 60s into the 90s, the pigs still eat. You know, the whole film beating in L.A. that everyone has seen, and all the questions that are across American cities.
He doesn't come out right out and say who the real enemy is, but he is very pointedly saying, you are the real enemy,
yep.
Yourself.
Right. Know the real enemy. Who's asked to change here? It's always, it's the guy standing on the leaning against the post. It's always the individual, not the collective society. He's perhaps, I don't know. Well, I do, I guess. He's perhaps given up on it. Well, we have some more time, and let's go back to this powerful poem by Gwendolyn Brooks, The Mother. If you had read these ahead of time, I would let you pick the poem to look at, but you haven't, and we don't want to take that kind of time, so I'll just get you through this. At the end of this, I'll read it through, and at the end of this, I'll ask you, what is this poem about? And there'll be several answers, no one right one. Lots of right answers, you say. Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or with no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You'll never neglect or beat them, or silence or buy with the sweet. You'll never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You'll never leave them, controlling your luscious sigh, return for a snack of them with the gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind the voices of my dim, killed children. I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said, sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted or lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, your aches and your deaths. If I poisoned the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. But why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine, since anyhow you are dead. Or rather, or instead, you were not made. But that too, I am afraid, is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you had body, and you died. It's just that you never giggled, or planned, or cried. Believe me, I loved you. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly. And I loved you all. What's that about? You know, that's not a trick question.
I think about the black mothers in the ghettos whose male sons never make it to 20. Whose female children die while they're still walking around.
Same with the Native Good. Americans. It's amazing how many of them get clipped off before they're 20.
And what makes you think of that? I mean, if you didn't know Gwendolyn Brooks was black, what would you do?
Well, it fits regardless of nationality, color, creed, or what have you.
Is that a good poem?
These are dreams that die.
the 20-year-old son that isn't going to make it, so you abort. I mean, that's your combining.
I'm not thinking about abortion.
I think this is a
conscience. It may be about abortion, I don't know. But I'm thinking about, my experience is that there were not a lot of abortions in the black community that I was involved in. But in terms of becoming all that one's, having one's child become all that one's child could become, it's like it's aborted.
It for sure, that's good. The poem for sure moves into that, that, you know, your dreams, your lovely, your tumults, your marriages, your aches, your deaths, you're not going to attain those. But it does start with abortion. Abortions will not let you forget. But it moves into the realm you're talking about. That's right. Any kind of... Good.
I wonder if... I too, understand that abortion is not... There's not a high rate among the black community today. But we think back to the slave times. How many black women aborted babies that were conceived with white men?
A generalization about slave babies and what slavery did to families is that the father-child relationship in many, many cases was zero. And the second dimension of that kind of parental relationship to the baby is that the mother's relationship lasted how long? Through nursing. And then she went back to work. The baby was somewhere else, and when it was old enough to do whatever it could do, then it did that too. And the relationships, you know, the kinds of, and the profound historical changes that the historical effects of that is a part of this too. That's a good observation. What struck you most about this poem? You could read it, and you perhaps would read it with different dramatics, you know, maybe some different emphases.
Plainly, the anguish of this mother having made this decision over. Most of us say, you know, we look at pro and con abortion and we talk about it very objectively, and this is not
very
subjective.
This is not an objective thing, is it? We can sit down and have all our intellectual debates that we want, and throughout America it's going on about abortion and, you know, all the different phrases that we have. This is, and this moves us into another dimension, I hope, that poetry is about experience. And poetry is also experience. And for a moment, some of us experienced the dilemma, the terror. Believe that even in my deliberateness, what's the deliberateness? We did it. I mean, the fetus is gone. Believe that even in my deliberateness, because there's no halfway to it. Believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate.
This being forced into an abortion rather than having an abortion for convenience sake.
Yep. Somehow forced.
Well, as the nurse, we used to have vignettes on examples of mothers that chose abortion, and they were, you know, different circumstances in life. And then always at the end of the film, it was the grieving process that we as nurses had to deal with the mothers. And I thought of this poem would be the epitome of the depth of what they experienced.
It is a beautiful lament.
Yeah, it is. Believe me.
It feels to me like it simply doesn't matter. It doesn't matter why you had the abortion, for good reason or bad reason. It simply doesn't matter. The reality is the sadness.
Yeah.
This anguish.
Very good.
Good.
Yeah.
Good reason.
Yep. And it's never even brought up, is it? We don't know why. So then, abortion is the vehicle in this poem to talk about something else, I think. And that is?
Loss.
Yeah. Well, I didn't hear it.
Loss.
Grief. Loss. Deep sorrow. And she must be sorrowful as she, because she's able to just go through all the things that, you know, we've all done it. If you're a parent, you look in, you know, we don't do it anymore. I don't anymore. They're 15, and who wants to look at, you know. But when they're babies, you look in and they're, wow. You know, a luscious sigh returned from, what's the line? Yeah, well, she's going through that. You'll never, look what she, the damn small, not that line. The singers and the workers will never handle the air. You'll never neglect them. Oh, I forgot, I got to put, or beat them. I mean, the spanking that's in love or whatever, you know. Or silence, or buy with a sweet. I mean, she lists all of them. That's loss, and that's what she has lost. The things that create the relationship.
She must have had a family, or she wouldn't be able to write about this.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine anyone who hasn't had a child being able to write that phrase, controlling your luscious side, returning for a snack, and a godly mother. I can't imagine anyone being able to picture that if they haven't done it. Maybe so, but I don't remember.
So maybe she's had a child, the speaker of the poem.
Right.
Yeah. Which makes the loss more understandable. And
she says, I have contracted, and that struck me as the incredible weight of her decision and the huge responsibility that only a mother can feel.
Yeah. I have contracted. It's okay. Absolute. It's
or
heavy.
Contracted contractions.
Yeah.
Pain and or feeling what it's, feeling it.
Yeah, I've never thought of that. That's good. It makes sense.
Yeah, I don't think this is a clinical abortion. This is a bacteria abortion where you ended up flushing the fetus down a toilet after having been treated locally. So you went through contractions and you had to look at what you were doing before you flushed it.
Yeah, okay. And then the poem ends. It's about loss. And it's about, believe me, I loved you. Is it hard to believe? I mean, wherever you are on the abortion issue, is it hard to believe that a woman would choose abortion and then say, believe me, I loved you?
She's exonerating herself, too, though why should I find that the crime was other than mine?
Yeah.
And it wasn't the first time because these are children rather than child.
And I loved you all, right? So she's had more than one. She doesn't dump the responsibility on anybody else. Why should I worry that the crime was other than mine? But what do you do with this? Believe me. There's another, I left off all on this, and there's another edition of this that also leaves off all, and I prefer that, so that's why I did it. Believe me, I loved you. Believe me, I knew you, and it does end with all of them. Believe me, I loved you. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly, and I loved. This is the fourth time coming up. I loved you all. It's a poem about love. How can that be?
This, I think, sorry, the something of it is in the line, which isn't, I don't think, just part of the list, because it comes first. I will never neglect or beat or silence. That no knowledge that the relationship that she would have had with his child, that she would have been forced into with his child, would have been far more destructive than what she did. I think it's picturing that this is the kind of relationship she would have had with this child. She would have done things that she would consider to be horrible, that her circumstances would have forced her into.
And, though, she will also wind up the sucking here, your thumb.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And there are no ghosts in here. I'll take care of them. And leave, come back. Love that kid.
This could well be a poem written by Mother Teresa.
She's an example of love.
I think that last believe me is a real painful plea in a couple directions. Believe me I love you, she's trying to reconcile herself what's happened, believe me, but also then they hint at some other societal, other groups who don't believe her. Mm-hmm. Believe me.
Yep.
It's real strong.
It's a plea. Yeah, that's very good. It's a plea. And believe me, I loved you. You guys believe me.
I think there's also a sense here of universality, that this is more than one mother, the workers and the singers have overcome. I think that perhaps it's the mothering of humankind, the universal mother, looking back and saying, this has happened. And yet, within the context of motherhood, I've loved all of this.
Yeah. Very good. I'll tell you a little anecdote to end here in 30 seconds. I have a one-man play show that kind of tours around, most especially the Midwest, but around. And one of the poems that is in that is this one. And I have it memorized, and I kind of act it out. And after one show, a woman whom I knew, and I knew her stand on abortion, came up to me and said, can you get me a copy of that poem? It's exactly in support of what I believe about abortion. And she was what the society calls pro-life. I personally have never liked that phrase. Other people aren't pro-life too, but she's a pro-lifer. And right after she left, another woman came up who is pro-choice, said, can you get me a copy of that poem? It's exactly what I want. That says something about the politics of the poem, and it moves it out of the realm of politics. I mean, here's two people on opposite ends of the poem who both want this poem. Why does it speak to them? Is this a poem about love and choice and spiritual agony? And that the intimacy of that personal love has had to make choices that are far out of the political realm, aren't they? And the economic and the religious and the social, other than to her, personal self. But they're all in that most intimate sense of, how do I love? Believe me, I loved you. Well, that raises the poem out of, I think, you know, kind of a social treatise. Into that realm of, again, the good poetry has to do, into that realm of spiritual connectedness, of trying to define who am I as a spiritual being. You guys are great. You defined radical in poetry and did this well, and I'll have a good day.
Thank you.